It's a very different story. Instead of let's get together and have an adventure and then get treasure and go home and you'll be better, I very explicitly say that your adventure is at home with your family, with the people you love.
My name is Tim Anderson. Welcome to Father and Friend, where men learn to live for the good of their families. And today we are with Jason Frischman. He is the father of two, a partner, a trained psychologist, and a men's coach for fathers.
So I have two sons. And one of the things that my wife and I were always really clear about is, you know, we are physical with our kids, right? Like boys need physical touch and emotion and just as much as anyone else. And, you know, one of our goals was to have mushy boys, so to speak, right? And so one of my greatest papa wins, I'd call it, is I have a 16, almost 17 year old kid who's taller than me, who still regularly like wants to crawl into my lap and cuddle up. And, you know, we every single night, one of our routines, I have never, actually, I can say I've twice in their life missed a night where I say the same 12 words and I give them a kiss before bed. So if I'm away, I write it on it, and I can't call, like if I'm camping or something, I'll write each individual night on a card that has the 12 words. And, if they're away, I'll put it in their backpack or I'll call. But, except for, I think, two times, even since they were an infant, I have never missed a night of our saying and our kisses.
Would you mind sharing what you're saying is? What is that secret sauce right there?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is I will say that the consistency and intention are much more the secret sauce than the actual words. But the words I use are, I love you for always and forever. You're my sweet one. And I have been saying it, you know, like I said, I have a 13 and a 16 year old son. Two sons, and the way the ritual goes is I say it to them and give them a kiss, then they say it back to me and give me a kiss. And we've been doing it, you know, and you know, we're not perfect, so as father sons we argue, and you know, and there have been nights when I have not wanted to say it. I have not, you know, and I like stand outside their bedroom and steel myself, and I'm like, I'm the adult. I am the adult, so I walk in and I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna say it. You don't have to, but I you know, I mean it no matter what. And the real benefit has been, and this is a big part of the work that I actually do with fathers, a big insight, which is this is all a long-term journey, right? So even if we are in a horrible, horrible argument, fight, we're not talking to each other, any of those things, I'm committed to being his dad and loving him forever. And so the long-term perspective that saying that every single night, even in the midst of conflict, is this wonderful daily reminder that perspective is such that I will never give up on him. I will never like close the door on something or whatever. And it's a wonderful practice of every day reaffirming that. It's become sacred to me.
That's neat. So what do you, when you do that, is that every night or every morning or?
Every night right before bed.
Every night before bed. Okay. So what is it that you want your sons to learn? What do you want to teach them from that? What is the sort of underlying value that you're trying to have them hold on to?
Yeah. Well, the first one is what I already mentioned or referred to was this like long-term perspective, right? This is a commitment and I don't take commitments lightly, never have. And they're my people, right? So the value or the lesson is really that like we are consistent, we are connected regardless forever. And the other piece though, on a more maybe mundane and no less important sort of side or perspective, is that the ongoing and intentional little actions are really important, right? And so, you know, just going and saying it, and sometimes it is like very poignant and emotional. Like, I'll take my kid's head and I'll say it to him and look in his eyes. And sometimes it's like very quick and I love him for always and forever, years we want. You know, but the intentional, consistent and regular commitment to doing it is something that I think as a lesson for my boys can be really applied to almost anything, right? We succeed not with big, grandiose, epic things, but with small, consistent, intentional actions.
Yeah, I guess along with that goes that stability and perseverance.
Yes.
You're creating some kind of stability in your relationship that will last them much longer than that one time you took them to some great vacation, but you didn't say, I love you ever, you know? So.
Absolutely. I mean, they, you know, it's funny you say that. I've talked to my older son, has often asked, he's interested in the business of the work that I do with fathers. And he'll say, like, why is this so important to you? And why do you, you know? And I said, well, there are many, if not most, young boys and fathers who do not regularly say, I love you, who do not regularly kiss and hug one another. Mm-hmm. And that breaks my heart. And so there's also a transparency that I have with my kids where I am vulnerable and open and human to them, you know, and I think that's also part of it.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So how did you start doing this? What was the reason that this particular routine came into being? Did you grow up with that? Did you not? Help me understand that.
No, I didn't grow up with it. Although I will say both of my mom and my dad are super affectionate and you know, so they, I certainly grew up with that. But in terms of this particular routine, it just felt natural. I mean, like I said, I started it when both of my boys were infants. Mm. And I felt like, you know, at that point I was leaving the house more often than my wife was to go to the office. And so it felt like the shorter amounts of time that I had literally in the same space as my kids, I needed and wanted to be more intentional and more thoughtful. And so it felt like, you know, back when they were teeny tiny, right? It felt like a beautiful sort of bookend to the day. Mm. And I'm someone who I like routines. I like rituals. I think that I often say bookends. I use that as an example because if we have really good bookends to our activities, the activities sort of take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. But in the transitions and the bookends, that's where we can really demonstrate value and we can demonstrate heart and love. And so I've always felt that. And, you know, I've done that in my own life. But as a parent, I think, you know, finding where those bookends are and making intentional kind of, you know, bookmarks would be are things I've always valued. And so that was probably one of the first ones.
Yeah, that's an interesting idea of a bookmark. You know, you take it out of a book every single time, you put it back in, and over the course of time, it becomes the bookmark you use in that book. You know, and yeah. So kind of like a, like you said, a marker, a milestone, a keyframe. You know, in video editing, they have keyframes. Yeah, those become keyframes in a way for your children to sort of hold on to and remember.
And you know, from my psychology training, neurologically, we're often geared to remember the hard stuff, right? Because mm-hmm. evolutionarily, we had to remember that, like, you know, those berries killed someone, and that cliff is bad, and there's a bear in that cave, and so we're neurologically wired to remember the danger, the hard stuff, the things, and yet. The positive value-based, you know, loving connections, we have to work a little harder to bookmark. And mm-hmm. so a lot of the practice that I do in my own life and in the work that I do is really how do we bookmark so that when I think about my story, when I think about my own past narrative, my own plot lines, it isn't just full of the times I made mistakes. You know, there are so many men and so many fathers that are plagued by the mistakes they made. Mm.
Yeah, that's all you remember. You saw a beautiful sunset, and then it rained, and all you remember is the rain.
Yeah, 100%. Rather than, and I'm certainly not Pollyanna-ish or like, make everything rosy. But at the same time, as you develop a mindset like this, you can find beauty in the rain.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, there's, you know, I say with a lot of the clients that I work with is there is magic in the muck. Mm-hmm. Now it's still mucky. Let's not try to like fake and say, oh yeah, it's lovely. It's still muck. But that's where the magic and the like the treasure that, you know, we find upon reflection, it lives there. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's not only in my work, but in my life. That's really what I try to remind myself all the time, like daily.
That's great. So it sounds like you learned the sort of principle of being affectionate with those that are close to you while you were growing up, and you've taken that and sort of boosted it or like applied it in a different way to your own family. Would that be an accurate way to summarize that?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know if it's an interesting concept, because now I think I'll go and ask my parents. They're fortunately still around, but I don't know how intentional it was for them. Like, I just think it was them, right? They are affectionate people. They're loving. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, my father was not one who used the words "I love you" very often. But it was very clear how loving he has always been. So I'm curious to see how intentional they were about it, rather than it just being an expression of who they were.
Right.
It's an expression of who I am and who my wife is, but we are also very intentional about it. And so that's taking it to the next level that I think fathers really would benefit from.
That intentionality is really thinking through what they're doing and what the impact is.
Yes, absolutely. You know, we're often, and rightfully so, we're often as parents sort of like, you know, doing it by the seat of our pants there, you know, and that's fine. But if we have, again, the bookends, if we have the transition moments as set as we can, then the seat of our pants for everything else is a lot easier.
That's great. So I imagine these are connected, because your second item that you put on here was regular family meals. And that's also a very sort of way to show affection, be together. So help me understand how that came about and how, what that looks like for you guys to sit down. Is it every meal? Is it once a day? Do you talk? Do you have planned things you do? Or is it just like, hey, we just sit here and hang out? Help me understand that.
Well, it's a little bit of everything, I'll say. You know, the history of it is, in addition to being a psychologist and a coach, I'm a cook and a food educator, and I care very deeply about foodways and traditional food systems.
Yeah.
And so even before my kids were born, even before I met my wife, I was working full-time as a therapist and full or part-time as a cook in a restaurant. And so... Okay. I've always been very passionate about food and service, serving, you know, nourishment, both metaphorically and literally. And so even before, really and truly, even before I had kids, this idea of regular meal times has been a deep value of mine. You're right. Companion means, you know, someone you break bread with. And, you know, whether it's gluten-free otherwise. But so with my kids, I would say right now we have the vast, vast majority of dinners 7 days a week together. Obviously, with schedules and things like that, it doesn't always work. But I would say for the most part, we have almost every single dinner together. Lunches were obviously, the kids are at school, but you know, I have an eighth grader and an 11th grader, and I still make their lunches. I still send them love notes in their lunchbox every day. And you know, I've made it clear to my older son that like, if he ever wants something different, he's welcome to tell me and I will, but otherwise I'll keep doing that. Mm-hmm. And so we have an intention where, you know, we start every single meal. It was interesting, you know, some families do a blessing or a prayer. Some families do, you know, a statement, or, you know, we want it to be very simple and very repeatable. So we all hold one another's hands. We look at each other and we say, Yum. And it just brings us into the moment. And it is a reminder, we live in rural Vermont, so a lot of our food comes from local farmers and local producers. And so it's a reminder of where all of the food comes from the, you know, for usually me, but in general, whomever prepares the food. And it's a way of grounding and centering us in that moment. Mm. And it's lovely because even if one of us happens to not be there, if my wife is out with friends, if I'm out, if my kids are doing something, when we go to hold hands, after we say yum, whoever's missing, we raise our hands and we go, you know, mama or whoever it is, just to call them into the space. Yeah. And we do, you know, when we have friends over, we do it with them. Mm-hmm. And then the mealtime, you know, it's everything from typical kind of how is your day, you know, to playing dinner games to sometimes it's quiet if we're all just tired. But again, we start with yum. And then when we end with, we all sort of help, we have our jobs to clean up. And so we have, again, the bookends. We have the transition time really dialed in so that when we're sitting at the table, it's lovely. You know, and it's a lot, there's a sense of ease. But for me, mealtimes are deep and meaningful. They come from my, you know, my history culturally, they come from my education as a psychologist. My very first side business as a psychologist was something called Everyone Around the Table, which spells eat. And it was supporting families doing family meals and the importance of that. And so in addition to just simply loving food and cooking and the act of bringing food to someone, I also know how vitally important it is for the health of families to spend some time doing food, you know, either preparation, mealtime or cleaning or combination together.
Yeah, that's so neat that you have that skill that you can bring to the family. And you said you some of that comes from your cultural background. What can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. You know, we were texting a little bit, but that's why I recognized the Aleph. And so I come from a Jewish background.
Okay.
And, you know, the joke in Judaism is that most if not all of our holidays are, they tried to kill us, they didn't, let's eat.
That is so true. I never even thought about that. But like all the Old Testament stories are basically that.
Yeah. And so, you know, the idea of a ritualized meal has always, I mean, you know, I make a lot of like, I'll make a chicken stock from scratch from the bones of the chickens we have. And, you know, I can't make a chicken stock without tearing up and thinking about my grandma, because I watched her do it my whole life. And so ritualized meals and meals that are both meaningful and symbolic are some of the most important things for me, you know, either both through my Jewish history and growing beyond that in many ways. But this idea that sitting around the table or sitting in front of TV sometimes, right? Like Friday nights, we watch a movie together, right? But sitting together.
Sitting together, yeah.
Yeah, it creates an arena for storytelling. And that to me is really the place where we build our character, we develop our character, and we support our relationships in a way that doesn't happen in any other way as well or as effectively.
Mm. Do you, when you have those overlaps with some of the Jewish traditions, do you do like a traditional Passover meal? Or being a cook, I would think that's almost irresistible to have, you know, this event that you can really sort of prep in a very sort of significant way?
Yes and no. So like, and Passover is a great example because while I'm not particularly observant for a lot of different Judaism, Judaic history or culture, Passover is one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. It involves a meal. It involves this concept of liberation and freedom. There is a political element and social justice element to it. So there's so much about Passover. So that's a great example. I live in Vermont. The rest of my family lives in New York. So when we're together, like when we go down to New York, I'm usually not the cook. I'll help heat things up or do a dish. But
you're a sous chef when you go to New York.
Exactly. I do the timing of things and whatnot. And in that sense, it's much more traditional. And I think that it is incredibly meaningful. It brings back some of the recipes from my childhood and all of those things. When we do it here in Vermont, we don't have very many Jewish friends. And so we invite our close friends into our traditions. Mm-hmm. And because of that, I mix more traditional recipes with more fun, not more fun, because it's not really fun, but more creative new things that I try to do. You know, I grow in for Passover, horseradish is a big part of the tradition. Yeah. My grandparents, when they came to the United States and after World War II, they lived in Queens, New York, and they planted a horseradish, you know, root in their backyard. So that was, you know, many, many, many years ago. Right. When they moved from New York City to Pennsylvania, they dug up the horseradish root and planted it there. And then about maybe 6 or 7 years ago, when they got rid of their place in Pennsylvania and moved closer to my parents, I drove to Pennsylvania, dug up that root and brought it here. And so now I have this, I don't know, maybe 60 plus year old horseradish root that's growing in my yard.
Wow, so that's really awesome.
Those things, yeah. So those things are the meaningful things. There's no one in my family that likes horseradish other than me, but I'm gonna pick a piece up every year for Passover.
Yeah, that's meaningful. History right there. That's really cool.
Yeah,
so I feel like that reminds like me. That. Yeah, that reminds me a little bit of people who have the 100-year-old sourdough starter.
Yes, which by the way. That I actually am a big, I do a lot of sourdough. The old sourdough starters are actually, other than the meaning and the sort of emotional meaning, are not any more special than a new starter. They're not tastier. They're not, you know, anything else, but that's a whole other conversation.
That's cool. So you've talked about hugs and kisses, regular family meals. You also wrote Routines, Rhythms, and Rituals. So I imagine you have other things that you also do. Maybe pick one or two or three of those other rituals, routines, and rhythms that you have chosen to implement in your family that you feel like are have been positively impactful in your family or that every dad can do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just really quickly, the reason why I write Routines, Rhythms, and Rituals in that way is that I see them as all really intimately connected, but not the same, right? So a routine is something that we're like, all right, I want to brush my teeth. So I have to build a routine in the morning where I do this, 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 and this, and I brush my teeth. And it is helpful, it's supportive, it's routine, it's regular. I may be exaggerating a little bit, but to the point, I would say a routine is a little bit soulless. Right. It is just something we do to maintain. But it's incredibly important. So I don't mean to say soulless and diminutive that way, but it is an action. A rhythm is when we take that action and we build meaning into it. So it's meaningful. Right. And what that looks like is, you know, back to brushing teeth, is that if I'm brushing my teeth, let's say I build the routine of brushing my teeth whenever my kids do. Then I'm building in the meaning, which is it's important to me to be a model for my children. I don't just tell them what to do. I do it. That's one of my values. So now it's not just a routine. There's this rhythm where, well, we get up and we together, we do X, Y, and Z. And within the like collective, you know, groupings of actions, one of them is that we brush our teeth together and it becomes a rhythm of like, it happens all the time. And it was a long time for me to really think about what's the difference between rhythm and routine. It's a little easier when we get to ritual, but rhythm and routine, you know, I see that routine, a rhythm is a routine that is sort of has deeper meaning, and it is regular and consistent and not just rote, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Right. And so then the third of the ritual is when we can take the rhythm that has become so much a part of what we do, and we can generalize it more about who we are. Mm-hmm. And so then once it's generalized, I can also utilize it I might say, all right, where else in my life can I brush my teeth? Where else in my life can I be a model for my children? Where else? And then I can build ritual in a way that is symbolic and not more than meaningful, right? So for example, a good one is, you know, and I suggest this to lots of dads, is I have a secret handshake with both my boys. And it
became, I guess you can't tell me what it is.
Well, I can't, but what I will say is that it is one that can be done for at a distance. You know, let's just say, you know, I will say, let's just say it's like waving, right? Yeah. Let's say it's a high five. Mm. Well, from a distance, it can still be a wave. It can be one of these, right? That's not what it is, but so that started out as a routine where every day as they got out of the car for school, we would do the handshake. Mm-hmm. Then it became meaningful because we would do it more often when, like, my kids were nervous for school. So there was a meaning. It was, basically the handshake meant, came to mean, I love you. Mm-hmm. So we did the handshake instead of saying, I love you, or in addition to, and it became something that had a deeper meaning. It became a rhythm. Mm-hmm. And then it was ritualized where, you know, even as I drive away from the school, if my kid's having a hard time, I can literally from a distance do this and know that it is not just, or I'll send a text message in the middle of the day of a picture of a hand and he knows what I mean. Mm. Right. So it's been now symbolically generated bigger than just shaking hands. Right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that, so there's a daily or even multiple times a day of our handshake. But then when I think again of routines, rhythms, and rituals, they can be weekly, monthly, yearly, seasonally, and we can always think about those things. So another one back to meals is every one of my family members, including me, has a very specific birthday meal. Mm-hmm. And so they choose it. It can change, it can evolve, but they have 100% say. If they say for my birthday, I want to have 5 gallons of ice cream, that's what they get. There's no limits. Financially maybe, or resource maybe, but like there's no limits in terms of health or any of that. It's your birthday. You know, for example, my birthday dinner since I was about 20 has been, and this is coming from someone who I'm a big foodie. But my birthday dinner is pizza, bagels, and tater tots.
Nice. Pizza, bagel, and tater tots. Oh, what a great combo.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, and I love it, right? You know, my kids have now, they're doing much more gourmet things, but so it has become this thing that is, again, it's routine, it's meaningful, and it's symbolic because it means so much to all of us. So we have yearly birthdays, we have we do something at the start of every season, we do things you know, every Friday, like if I say Friday, we're going to do Friday night dinner, it's very far from a Sabbath or a Shabbat dinner because we're often doing, we often do a sausage sandwich and a movie, but the ritual of it is the same. We have the exact, like if I said to my kids on a Wednesday, we're having Friday night dinner tonight, they would know exactly what it was. In fact, this past Friday, we all had something to do. So yesterday, Sunday night, we had Friday night dinner. Mm. And so it becomes symbolically, you know, we can generalize it to other times, other days. And so we have a Friday night dinner. We have, like I said, the notes and the daily, the love notes in their lunch bags. We do those. I do a lot of those kinds of things so that they know, to go back to the bedtime saying, is they know there's a foundation. They have an expectability, a predictability, a consistency, all with intention. And at the same time, they know I'm fallible. So we screw it up sometimes, and that's okay too.
How did you, so with these rituals, these require some brain capacity, some focus, some effort. And I think that's always required. But how did you do this? You mentioned earlier you were maybe working away from the house more often.
Yeah.
How did that work when you were working away from the house, and then what did the transition to working at the house more, how did that change those routines and rituals?
It's a great question. I think working away from the house made it almost more poignant. Like we had to be concise. We had to be, you know, like doing a quick handshake was good because I often had to drop them off and race to my office, you know? And so it made it more efficient. A lot of what I do in my own life, because I'm not that organized and I'm, you know, typically not the most direct line, you know, linear thinker, is when I am doing things, I want it to be as effective and efficient as possible because it usually takes me a while to get there. And so because I was out of the house more often, there had to be an intentional and sort of succinct way to have these meaningful moments. And what that's really been beautiful is, you know, when I work with fathers now, one of the biggest challenges or obstacles is time. For all of us.
Yeah, for everybody. So,
yeah, I mean, absolutely. And so, like, for example, I have a handout that I often give the guys that I work with that is like my 10 favorite ways to connect with your kids. And all of them, if you did every single one, it takes less than 10 minutes a day. Right. They are all things that, you know, that the handshake is on that list. The bedtime saying is on that list. You know, that took, you know, 22 seconds or whatever it is. And so the development of it really came out of necessity. And now that I'm home a little more, you know, it's reversed a little bit because now that I'm home more working in, this is my office at home, my kids are away more, right? They're at school, they're at after school, they're things like that. And so I still have to be efficient, but what's also changed is like, I can take the time, right? If I have a client that cancels next hour, I can go upstairs and we're still on food. So I can go and prep dinner. So that way, when my kids get home, I'm less time in the kitchen and more time with them, you know? So I can be more planful and I can spend a little more time in that way. But at the same time, you know, when I, another routine or rhythm that we do is Monday nights, my wife, I hate to say it this way, but is off, right? Like I take the boys and we do something so that she can do whatever she wants. And I get some special time because like I said, I'm out of the house more. And we've been doing that since they were very, very little. And initially because I think of food, I was like, great, you know, I'll make a special dinner for them and we'll hang out tonight. And what that turned into was me making a special dinner, us eating and cleaning up. And then it was time for bed. And I was like, wait a minute, right? So
over not what years, I was going for, yeah.
No, not at all. I mean, it was lovely, but I have two kids who now have amazing palates. But the truth was, is some of our, it's Monday nights. Monday night is, we call boys night. And some of the best Monday nights have been PBJ or a quesadilla or leftovers wrapped up in a tortilla or some, or a store-bought sandwich on the way to go fishing or, you know, so it becomes less about, so that's another thing, like we've generalized. It's not about the meal, it's about the time. And so now our Monday nights, you know, we whip together some food, like we'll do it tonight. But it's really about being together, whether that's going fishing or playing a game or watching a movie or whatever it's going to be. The time is spent together as much as possible rather than, you know, me being in the kitchen and hoping they'll be okay. Now, again, the tables have turned. Now I'm ready and they're like having to do homework. So I want to be, the moment they're finished, I want to be available for them.
Yeah. It seems like a lot of families struggle with the, we have tasks to do like eating dinner or getting ready for school or going and picking up people and dropping it off and driving around places. It sounds like you've done a really fantastic job of having your mindset focused on the, when I do those tasks, those things, those are not, it's not really to complete the task. It's to flourish our relationship, to develop our relationship, to be together. And help me understand how you would help somebody who might be very task driven, who's like, I just need to get this thing done. And I know my kids are with me, but I got to finish this thing.
You're talking about many of my clients. So ye there is obviously and necessarily a task requirement. We have to get things done, right? We have to clean the dishes. We have to get somewhere. Mm-hmm. All of those things. So, you know, first and foremost, I would start with someone who's very task oriented by saying, like, yes, that's valid. You have to get those done. Now let's take a step back and go and look at what are your values? What's your treasure? What are the things that are, you know, obviously, if you didn't do any dishes for a week, it would be, you know, a blank show, right? Like, yeah. It'd be a mess. There'd be flies there, you know, but if you didn't do the dishes today because your kid needs something or because you need something or it's the space that is like, oh, what I really value and desire in my relationship would require us to do something, then the dishes can wait, right? But that only comes, like most people will roll their eyes when I say that, unless we've first done the work of what are our values? What are my treasures? What are the things that I truly desire in this journey of parenting, right? And, you know, I can hold people accountable, right? If someone is like really, truly detail-oriented and won't shake from that, then we have to ask hard questions, like really and truly, by your actions, what are you showing is most important? And is that okay with you? Maybe it is, right? Like, and so we have to go to sort of family values and beliefs around roles. A lot of what I do with men is let's deconstruct and take apart what the roles of men in a family, in a home are, and really see if we can challenge that, you know, and it doesn't mean that all of a sudden everything has to change, but we do have to look at, like, everyone's busy. Everyone's got time crunches. Everyone's doing things. So what is it that you want? Like, let's take a step back and really look at what's priorities. And really what, you know, what are the challenges or obstacles or little monsters and buggers that get in the way from you actually living and doing the things you want? You want a close relationship with a kid. You got to spend time with them. You got to, like, you know, I hear from dads all the time, like, all they do is video games. I hate video games. I'm sorry, if all they do is video games, sit down and do something for a little bit. Yeah. And maybe if you build a relationship, you'll be able to get them into something else. Mm. But by immediately, like, saying, all right, great, they're doing that, so I can take care of task 1, 2, and 3, you might have clean dishes, but you're not doing anything that's going to help the depth of relationship with the people you purport to love the most.
Mm. That's good. What do you think as far as when you see a father who's maybe got a 12, 13, 14 year old, and for 12, 13, 14 years, he said, I'm busy. I'm good. You know, go get ready for bed. I got stuff to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then 12, 13, 14 comes around, and now he's ready to hang out, the dad. And he goes, hey, you want to hang out? He's like, nah, I'm good. And the dad feels a little bit like rejected, as he probably should.
Yeah.
How easy or difficult have you seen that transition for a dad who then says, hey, I'm going to be all in on this and I'm going to start pursuing this relationship in a different way? How long have you seen that requires before there's like a success? You know, what kind of hope can you give people?
Well, I love metaphors, so I'll use one to answer the question, which is, you know, anytime someone wants to lose weight and get fit, the way, and I've counseled and done therapy with people who've wanted to do that before. And so, you know, I have some authority when I say this, but when you want to lose weight and get fit, it will almost assuredly, barring any other medical things that we don't know about, but in general, it will almost assuredly take shorter than you expect, but longer than you want.
Mm.
And I think the answer is the same. If a dad is really ready to go all in and make changes, and frankly, getting some support and help in that, because I think it's a hard thing to do, there will be successes and wins almost instantaneously.
Mm.
But simultaneously, there will also be losses. Right. Because all of a sudden, you know, you've been telling a kid, go to bed, go to bed, go to bed. And then you're like, hey, let's talk. You're going to get a big F you. And that's just the way it is until they know, and you can establish consistency and intentionality and predictability, kind of what we talked about. Mm-hmm. It is never too late to do that. Truly, I've worked with like adult children and their parent and their elder parents, and we've done it then. And, you know, it's never too late. And frankly, it happens a lot more quickly than you think, but perhaps a little longer than you'd want.
Mm. That's good. I think that gives hope to people who would like something different that they maybe don't currently have. And that's what a lot of men need, is there is another way.
Absolutely. And it really does. I think that even when you start to not, when men start to do the inner work and have self-awareness and really stop to do the connection, even when there isn't the kind of win that we would love, right? Like all of a sudden I say, hey son, let's do something. Yes, I love you, dad. Let's go do that. Right. You know, even when we don't have that, what we do have is an internal awareness that we're on the right path. And I've talked to so many dads who, when they make that choice, you know, again, remember I said earlier, magic is in the muck. Mm-hmm. And so when they make that choice, there's an awareness and an acknowledgement, not necessarily desire or enjoyment, but there's an awareness that the muck is going to happen. I'm entering it purposefully. And so I teach guys that very often, how do you find the little wins? How do you find that hope? Because, you know, I come from a place where I know without a shadow of a doubt, I believe, and I've known from sort of psychological research and whatnot, that kids want to love and connect with their parents. That is, you know, we can say it's biological or nature or learned or whatever reason, narrative, whatever it is, children want to love and connect with their parents. Mm-hmm. And so if we allow that, if we let that happen by being on the path and doing the work and showing up and, you know, all of these things, there is hope. In my work as a psychologist, you know, I've worked with some of the most horrendously ruptured relationships that one might imagine. Mm. And there's hope. And many of the guys who go through my coaching program, you know, they're not horrendously ruptured relationships, but they want hope and they want to be connected. And they, you know, again, there's this change that needs to happen in men and in the men's narrative that we are loving and we are emotionally connected and we do have the innate capacity for emotional loving connections and expressions. Mm-hmm. And as we move towards that, it's healthful, right?
Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about your coaching program.
Sure.
And I'll send it to you. So, you know, you can use it for whatever you want if you feel like it's work for you.
Sure. You know, either way, I happen to love talking about it is, let's see, do you know this? I'll try to be quick because I do like to talk about it a lot. But do you know the hero's journey, the concept, the story of the hero's journey?
No. Tell me about it.
Okay. Very quickly. Because you'll recognize as I start, Hero's Journey was a narrative arc that was studied pretty extensively by psychologists, by folklorists, and for many, it was seen as sort of the story. And the story is, you know, the hero gets a calling or gets kicked, a call or a fall, to get kicked out of their place where they have to then go to a different realm and have challenges, climb the mountain, battle the dragon, you know, whatever it is, and they earn the token, the talisman, the treasure, to where they then have to come home and are either accepted and they save the home, or they are rejected and they go back out traveling, right? Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, most mythical stories, you know, right. All of these things, right? I studied that. I wrote my dissertation on that. Mm-hmm. And I developed for about 15 years therapeutic growth interventions based on it. Mm-hmm. And then about 15 years ago, I sort of had an insight or an awakening around that story is so everywhere. It's in every movie. It's in every Pixar movie. It's in the books that Blockbuster, that it's actually, I believe, quite damaging to men and boys. Because if I'm not epic and I'm not legendary, then who am I? And those stories where the focus is on the king, the prince, the hero, says nothing about the everyday. It says nothing about the like regular dude who's changing diapers and, you know, taking care of the hearth and, you know, cleaning the toilets, right? And because of that, I have seen more and more men are losing touch with this foundational magic of everyday life, right? This idea of intentionality, of lived values, lived experiences, basically the magic and the mundane. And so the coaching program that I do, or to step back, many, if not all of the men's coaching programs that I know of utilize the hero's journey as a metaphor for the work they do. And it's lovely.
Yeah.
That said, I refuse to do that because I feel like I said, it is, there's too many faults with it. It's not a complete story. It's very valuable. Like I said, I got my doctorate because I studied it. It's valuable. It's got a lot of use, but my initial program was called Adventure's Other Half because it was the foundational adventures that need, you know, to be developed, right? So even in all of the hero's journey stories, when the hero is at their hardest, you know, the dragon is stepping on their head or they're lost in the thing, what happens is that they find a talisman or they're reminded of their home or their values or why they're on the quest in the first place. And in today's day and age, we don't have that.
Right.
You know? And so my coaching program is called Journeyman. And it's a very different story. Instead of let's get together and have an adventure and then get treasure and go home and you'll be better, I very explicitly say that your adventure is at home with your family, with the people you love. What I offer is I call it a virtual inn. I get to be an innkeeper, back to the food. I get to be an innkeeper where men can step out of their everyday adventures, drop their shoulders, and really see and be seen. And so why do people go to an inn or a tavern or a pub or a cantina, right? They go to share stories, to get nourished and rest, to find new quests and new training or new tools, to get information from the shady guy in the corner, you know, like that's why we gather. And so the coaching program that I run is called Journeyman. The main primary, you know, in addition to doing talks and workshops and things like that, the main offer I have is something called what I call, again, it's an inn. So I call it the mug club. And so men, it's a membership program where men come. I have a curriculum that I've built over the last 20 years where every month has a theme. And every month I provide a 1 hour plus workshop on the theme, or I invite someone in as a guest for that. And then when men join the group or join the program, they're placed in a small group that meets every 2 weeks. And the small group is really about connections, accountability, utilizing the theme, building in on new tools. And in addition to that, they're all connected over text threads. And there are additional, you know, we'll do some book clubs or we'll do like other kind of offerings for guys as needed. But really, it's about how can men gather, connect, and support and provide accountability for one another. And it's all online. You know, one day I hope to do retreats, but right now it's all online. And it's really been a powerful thing where I watch. I mean, I got to tell you, I've been able to witness men being more open and vulnerable over text than most men ever. And so it's been a phenomenal and wonderful experience. As I invite more men into the program, we have more of a potential to really create a powerful support community.
That's really neat. It reminds me of, I've told this to my wife before, you know, this isn't quite a hero story, but it is in a way. But when you're in fifth or sixth grade and the teacher says, you know, you could be president one day, that's the, like, alluding to some hero story, like you could do this incredible thing that, you know, it's less likely you'll be the president of the United States than it will be you win the lottery.
Yeah.
But when you tell every class that passes through you that, you feel like you're supposed to do something extravagant. And I think you hit on something I think that's really right. And that is that so much of our life is not the extravagant. Maybe there are extravagant things that some of us get the opportunity to do, and that's fantastic.
Sure.
But most of life is the routine, ritual, and rhythms that you develop. It's the going to work. It's the taking care of your kids. It's the saying I love you every day. It's the going on a vacation with your family. It's the eating together. It's the vacuuming, the sweeping, the wiping, the mowing the yard. Those are the things that we do for the large chunk of our lives. It's not the extravagant thing. And so
how wonderful would it be if those things were imbued with meaning?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And not just tasks to get through so you can get to the imaginary extravagant thing that might come one day.
Exactly.
I think you're onto something there. That's good. Awesome. Hey, well, thanks so much for your time, Jason. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I really, I'm honored and delighted, really, to add. This is, as you can imagine, things I love talking about. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Fellow fathers and friends, so glad you could join us for this episode. To stay connected, visit our website at fatherandfriend.com. Sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and other social media sites. Be sure to like, follow, and share with fellow dads and families in your community. If you have a topic you'd like us to discuss, send us a message and let us know. Until our next episode, keep showing up, loving deeply, and making an impact for the good of your family. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Father and Friend.